Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 1981's Caveman, a slapstick comedy set in 1 zillion BC, October 9th to be exact, and it stars Ringo Starr in his last big notable acting role, at least when he's not playing himself or narrating a cartoon train. Ringo plays Atuk, a somewhat weedy caveman who finds himself at odds with his tribe's big brutish leader Tonda over the affections of the beautiful Lana. Once banished from his tribe, Atuk forms his own gang of caveman misfits, and together they encounter dinosaurs, discover fire, invent things like weapons and music and cooking, and all while spending the entire movie speaking a language of prehistoric nonsense words and grunts. But perhaps most significantly for this film was Ringo's determination to get back. Get back, as in Barbara back.
Yes.
His wife,
yes.
Get Barbara back.
Yes.
which is no insignificant thing, right? So this is the film in which Ringo met his wife of now 42 years, Barbara Bach.
Yeah.
For the rest of us, this is a silly slapstick film that we did or did not enjoy, and we'll get into that in a moment. But for him, it's almost fun to think that this is a film that must hold a very special place in his heart.
It must do, right? Yeah, I'm sure they must get the Blu-ray out once a year. And have a screening on their anniversary.
Yes, you know? Every year. Can you imagine they watch the film every year? As they whisper, Ireland are you.
I think it's... I think the knowledge that this is where they met, it sort of colours your watching of it. But you get that a lot with films in which the Beatles are actors, where you're very aware of the context around which they shot it and what was going on in their lives at the time. So it kind of tends to colour your thinking about the whole thing. But also, as much as him meeting Barbara Bach on this, like it does seem to be quite an interesting film in terms of the historical context, in terms of like where Ringo is in his life at this point. So this film comes out in 1981, which is obviously after John is murdered, but it is shot in February and March of 1980, so obviously before John is murdered. And it's also, Ringo flies out to shoot it about 3 weeks or so after Paul gets out of jail in Tokyo, after he's locked up there for for having marijuana in his bag, the dynamite weed in his bag. And as a result, when Ringo is trying to get into Mexico City, where Mexico is where some of the film is shot, he's strip searched at the airport, which seems seems to be a direct result of customs officials the world around thinking, well, Beatles carry drugs.
That's amazing, yeah. So. It's like specifically Beatles.
Right.
There
right.
are four people in the world that are carrying drugs right now.
Yeah, yeah. So they're all on a watch list now. There's pictures of all of them, like in like the back office of like every sort of every airport where the customs officials hang out. It's like, keep an eye out for these guys. Make sure you strip search.
Imagine how disappointed you are as that customs officer strip searching Ringo, like feeling absolutely positive you're going to find like a massive dose of drugs and then just finding a suitcase of beer.
Yeah, I mean, so listen, we can neither confirm nor deny whether Ringo brought a suitcase full of baked beans with him to Mexico, but I think surely he had it written into his contract that his trailer had to be stocked to the gills with them.
Stocked to the gills with beans. You mentioned before, by the way, that obviously the film was shot before John Lennon's death but released after.
Yeah,
we should mention that the October 9th date that appears at the start of the film, so it provides the context, and it comes up on screen saying 1 zillion years BC, which is obviously a reference to 1 million years BC, the earlier film from the 60s starring Raquel Welch. But then it comes up October 9th, which is actually a really nice, neat gag, I thought.
Yeah, that joke is actually... That joke is at the start of Life of Brian as well, isn't it, in fact?
Oh, is it?
Life of Brian is what, 1984? No, Life of Brian is 3 or 4 years later.
Mm.
And at the start, it says, you know, Palestine, whatever it is, BC. And then it says Thursday, right, around lunchtime or something
yeah,
like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah, of course, that rings a
it's
bell.
It's sort
yeah,
of like course. Being very specific about the date when no one needs you to be.
Yeah, yeah, which is brilliant. But I quite enjoyed that gag. But actually, also... there is a specific reason why that date was chosen, which is it's John Lennon's birthday, and it
yeah.
was, I guess, a tribute to Lennon following his death.
Yeah,
in a sort of a neat, nice, neat way. That's, you know,
yeah,
not too showy for a film that's essentially a slapstick comedy about cavemen.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's obviously it's a nice... I think it's a good way to do it. Actually, it's a nice little nod to him. Obviously, it would have been wholly inappropriate to get towards the end of the film and it said the caption to come up saying, "This film is dedicated to the memory of John Lennon." I don't think they could. I'm not sure how well that would have gone down. but actually, like, you know, so we're talking about, this is obviously a daft slapstick film, but Ringo's taking his acting career quite seriously.
Because is he? Because this is what I was going to ask you about.
Yeah.
Because I find it difficult, as a lot of things related to the Beatles, reconciling different things that we know about the Beatles happening at the same time.
Mm.
So I think of Ringo having a solo music career that coincides with an acting career. I guess I kind of assumed that at some point he focuses more on acting than music.
Yeah.
And this is the point where he's in it now.
I mean, he's releasing records around this time.
He is,
maybe
okay.
Ringo the Fourth is his most recent release, but don't quote me on that. But at this time, he is definitely aware of the fact that his sort of Beatles sheen, in terms of his sort of bankability or hireability as an actor, is sort of has worn off a bit.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And he's aware that, you know. So he says around this time, "No one is going to offer Ringo Starr a top role these days just because I used to be in the Beatles. I've got to be able to do the job. That's much more demanding, but much better too. I could end up with egg on my face, but succeed or fail, it's all down to me standing on my own 2 feet as an actor." So he is aware of the potential for his star to wane a bit.
Hmm.
Taking on something like this, you know, the merits of the film itself, you know, are up for debate, but it's certainly a bit of a challenge for an actor. Because, so as you pointed out in the introduction, there's no actual, or there's hardly any actual dialogue in this, sort of English dialogue. It's all a sort of very basic caveman language, so there are certain words that you come to understand what they mean. But basically, the actors here have to convey what they mean through gestures as well as the words they're saying, the sort of nonsensical words they're saying. So that's a bit of a challenge for an actor. And I think Ringo does it pretty well in general.
Like, yeah, it's interesting because I do agree that I think that it's probably easy to overlook the challenge of physical comedy and conveying a character through physical means, like, only.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I can't help but think that this feels like less of an authentic performance from him than we saw in That'll Be the Day, which we discussed in the earlier episode, and even Magic Christian.
Yeah.
That he has, it feels like he has more to do in those films. And I appreciate what you're saying about how he has to convey emotion and sentiment and express actions without actually being able to use words.
Yeah.
I just don't know if I buy that that's a really challenging thing to do when those actions and those emotions are quite simple.
Yeah.
In the film.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess going back to what you were saying earlier, and Ringo's quote about having to stand on his own 2 feet and succeed or fail, etc. Previously, you know, as I mentioned at the start of this, this was his last big acting role.
Yeah.
Really. So, failed? I don't know. Like, as in, I'm asking, I guess, you know, like, would we say, you know, if he was taking acting seriously at this point, did that end up becoming, in his mind, an experiment that actually didn't succeed at?
Well, I mean, the film didn't do very well, it's fair to say. And it also is not a film, it's not one of those films that was sort of disliked at the time, but has then been sort of critically reappraised. Critically did not go down that well. And if it has been critically reappraised since, then that reappraisal it ended up in people saying, yeah, actually, it is as bad as we thought it was in the first place.
Until now. Not until now, because I'm very much on that side. But actually, I do think that there is a little bit of a, from what I understand from sort of reading up on the film online, I do think that there is a, almost like a generational fondness for the film of people, particularly in the US, that grew up at a certain time where this film would play on network quite often.
Yeah.
And they see it as a childhood film that was seen, that they would see as kids.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Like, it almost has a second life. I don't think that wouldn't have been how the film was billed when it was first released. But actually, I can understand how it might have taken a little bit more of a fondness for a certain demographic who see it as a nostalgic treat.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, one of the interesting things about doing this podcast is that we have had conversations with listeners on social media who will say, we've sort of released episodes about films that we certainly didn't slag off but didn't think were particularly great, and had comments from listeners saying, oh, I've always really liked this film.
Yeah.
And often it is because it sort of came out at a certain time in their, I don't know, youth, or also, but their sort of Beatles education, or their sort of burgeoning Beatles fandom, that kind of thing. And for that reason, it's sort of quite special to them.
Yeah.
It happens a lot in general with, you know, there's lots of films that, you know, you can remember were just always on when you were a kid. And therefore, it doesn't mean you like them necessarily, but it does mean that they're quite sort of evocative to you of a certain time.
Yeah, of course. I completely understand that. That idea of having, you know, having our own social media followers contact us and tell us that actually that film that we criticised, they really loved. Feels like now would be a good time to really test that.
Well, funny you should say. I do think about Ringo's performance in the film. So like I say, I mean, this is a time in his life when I think he's drinking too much, and I think he is aware of the fact that he's drinking too much. I don't think he's quite faced up to his alcoholism yet, or perhaps think of it as such. But so he's split up from Maureen. So I think he's not living with his children anymore. It's sort of rumoured he was in a brief relationship with Shelley Duvall around this time, and certainly at the time that he goes off to shoot this film, he seems to be in a sort of on-again, off-again relationship with a model called Nancy Andrews. and it's sort of on again enough that it's a bit controversial that he gets together with Barbara. So he is in a bit of a state of flux. He's also just in 1979, nearly a year before, has had quite a serious life-threatening operation in Monte Carlo, I think it is, where some of the old sort of intestinal problems that he has since he was a kid have sort of flared up again. And I think the surgeons sort of describe it as being sort of touch and go for a while. It wasn't sure whether he was going to pull through, you know. So maybe that's made him reevaluate a few things and think about his career. But yeah, I mean, it's around this time. And one adjective that gets applied to Ringo quite a lot, especially in the context of the solo bits of his performance in A Hard Day's Night, is Chaplin-esque. People talk about him as being a sort of Chaplin type figure. And you can see that in this, in that he is the leading man, but he's not an alpha male. He will sort of outwit bigger, more brutish opponents. And of course, I mean, this having no dialogue, you know, is the what better way to be Chaplin-esque is not to be able to speak in it. Well, he can speak, but, you know, can't speak English, so he can't convey things through dialogue. And so the director, Carl Gottlieb, says, because this is a film he'd been preparing or trying to develop since about 1977, apparently, so it's taken a while. And I'm not sure whether he has gone through potential casting choices for the leading man. But he said, like, after he cast Ringo, he said, when you need a small, suave, funny, awkward, unprepossessing leading man, there aren't a lot to choose from. Dustin Hoffman, Dudley Moore, Robin Williams, and who else is there who's also a star? There's Ringo.
Wow.
So, I mean, that is, that's pretty exalted company that he's putting
exalted company, but also quite eclectic company.
Yeah, like, the Dustin Hoffman thing I see less, but I can completely see what he means with Dudley Moore.
Absolutely, yeah. Robin Williams, perhaps, yeah. I mean, you're right, Dustin Hoffman feels like the outlier there. I don't feel like Dudley, I don't think of Dustin Hoffman and Dudley Moore as interchangeable.
No, no, that's true.
But no, fair enough. But yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, and it's interesting that is that a quote that he said at the time?
Yeah, it looks like it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I can see that, and it's interesting that we said before. I think probably when we were talking about Magic Christian as well, that this kind of feels like it's within Ringo's comfort zone to be playing this kind of character.
Yeah,
almost a little bit of a put upon, almost like a sad sack figure with puppy dog eyes, but with comic sensibilities. You mentioned earlier that obviously Ringo was going through quite a big period of change. I don't know much about Ringo's life at this time, but is it fair to say then that him meeting Barbara Bach straightened him out a bit? Like, is, you know, that seemed to, for the fact that that relationship ended up resulting in this currently 42-year marriage, feels like it might have been a sort of a source of stability for him at that time.
Yes, but eventually. So I think the two of them, I mean, so they got together very quickly. They were married within a year. And they both went through alcohol and maybe drug rehab together, but like sort of more towards the end of the 80s, I think.
Right.
So if you think about that appearance on the Michael Aspel show where it's him and George being interviewed at the same time, which is great. And I think that's maybe 87-ish or something like that, I'm going to say.
Yeah, he's still like, an alcoholic then, right? He's still, but I don't. It's weird to talk about it in those terms because he doesn't come on that show visibly drunk.
Not in the same way that sort of Oliver Reed used to go on.
Exactly, that's what I mean, shows. Right? But he's clearly under the influence. You can see that he's a bit, like, you know, cocky and got that sort of swagger
for sure. Yeah.
Well, that I feel was part of our strength. Well, we were a band that were appealing to children, to grandparents, you know, like the Stones, where they were mainly on a teenage attitude.
Mm. You were...
How you doing, Mick?
You were always the down-to-earth one.
That's right.
What did you...
God, you're looking chubby.
Thank you.
What did you... I've got to behave. George's on.
So I think the Barbara Walters interview, where he's talking about John's murder, I couldn't tell you exactly when that was, but I'm going to say early 80s, I suppose. where he's sort of crying about it. And he's sort of, I'm not saying he was definitely drunk during that interview, but that was certainly around the time he was drinking and not in a good place in general, I think. So yeah, it's certainly true that that relationship has been a stabilizing influence for him. And what a lovely thing, you know, they're still together now. And it's, you know, and it's lovely to see, you know, they spend a lot of their time sort of tweeting pictures of themselves doing peace signs, you know, in their garden and stuff, and going to the Chelsea Flower Show every year. And it's great. But yeah, I think it took a while. And so they both had their own problems with alcohol, and then they both cleaned up together.
Yeah, that's nice. And the catalyst for all of that is obviously the exceptional movie Caveman.
Quite right. Yep.
Yep. So you mentioned that you think that Ringo is given a good performance in the film.
Yeah.
What do you think of the film generally as a whole?
I liked it more than I was expecting to. It is obviously very, very flawed. No one's going to call it a masterpiece. I think we had a conversation on a previous episode where I was making the point that if a film it delivers what it is attempting to, and therefore it is kind of succeeding on its own terms, I don't think there's any point in having that argument again, because, you know, as you rightly pointed out, you can say that about any art, basically.
I guess the counterpoint to that is the film sets its own bar very low.
then achieves it, then great. Good for it, you know. So I think it's a comedy, mainly a visual comedy, and I did laugh out loud 3 or 4 times, which is, to be honest, quite a lot for watching it's any comedy
more than
film.
You do in my company most times, so yeah.
Exactly, it's years since you made me laugh. But I think bits in it that I found really charming, particularly the stop motion animation dinosaurs, which sort of reminded me of this, because they were sort of they had to sort of convey threat while also being cartoonish and slightly cuddly, and they did both of those things at the same time, so that when they are sort of vanquished as a threat by being stabbed with a big pole or getting fed a berry so that they fall asleep and fall off a cliff, you did feel like a genuine threat had been extinguished, as opposed to, oh, here's a big cartoon dinosaur, it's not going to do him any harm.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously there is a limit to that. I get that it's not sort of Jurassic Park, with the T-Rex scene or anything like that. You know, it's a completely different thing.
I really like the design of the dinosaurs. Mm. They were threats in terms of the story, but they didn't look threatening in a film that is essentially a comedy. They had this sort of, all of them had this sort of cute, pudgy quality to them. It was quite, you know, quite fun and nice to look at. The guy that did that stop motion animation is the same guy that had done the same thing in 1 million years BC.
Yeah.
So he was obviously hired to do the sort of same effect here. I think the issue I had with the dinosaur scenes was that if you look at the film as a whole, from a plot perspective, it really is just kind of the cavemen doing a thing, and then they run into a dinosaur.
Yes.
and then they vanquish the dinosaur, and then they do a thing.
Yeah.
And then they run into a dinosaur.
Yeah.
And it does happen 6 or 7 times. In the film, I kind of felt like, I guess if you were being a little bit smarter now when writing that film, what you would do is you'd have those cavemen defeat those dinosaurs in a way that they learned something from, that then contributed to them in their final overthrowing of Tonda, the sort of bully leader guy. But it doesn't seem to happen. I don't think those scenes add anything to Atuk's, Ringo Starr obviously starring as Atuk's overall growth. It's literally just a series of skits with different stop animated dinosaurs.
I think that's fair. Yeah. But I mean, you mentioned Ringo's or Atuk's growth as a character. Yeah. And actually, I think that is achieved quite well. So obviously, this is a very broad strokes story. The story, to, you know, give a very general overview, is Ringo, or Atuk, played by Ringo, is sort of in the tribe of, what's he called, Tonda?
Tonda is the leader, yeah.
Yeah, the Tonda. And so Tonda's girlfriend is Lana, who's played by Barbara Bach, and Ringo is the sort of beta figure, and he gets thrown out of the, he gets cast out of the tribe. He has to go out on his own. He comes across, is he called La, played by Dennis Quaid?
Yes.
It's an early role for Dennis Quaid, and who is his friend. And they meet Tulla, who is played by Shelley Long. This is the first real thing that Shelley Long has done in her career, certainly the first big role. She gets, she starts on Cheers, playing Diane in Cheers about a year later. So Tala kind of falls for Ringo. She's a sort of girl next door figure, but Ringo really wants to sort of get back to Lana because that's the girl he's fallen for. And but his interest in Lana is sort of pretty purely sexual. So, I mean, if you pause here and think about what stories are generally doing here, you think about romantic comedies, what they're doing here, they're doing it with dialogue rather than sort of the sort of action and gesture that is being done here. But this setup happens a lot where the male lusts after a sort of impossible female figure who is not, we know not to be really suited for them because actually they're not an alpha male, and they want to think of themselves as an alpha male, and lusting after this woman is part of it. There is a girl next door figure who is often the sort of female friend who we know them to be more suited for. By the way, the same thing happens in Yesterday, right, which we've done an episode.
Yeah, of course. Good point. I was just thinking this is, I think this in terms of like American high school tropes, right? You know, you fall for the popular girl at school who's probably a bit of a mean girl, and then your female best friend is actually the one who's best suited for you.
Exactly. But yeah, so this setup is quite familiar, you know. So what happens is after Ringo has sort of vanquished Tunda in the end, in the sort of final fight, it looks like he's going off with Lana, and then there's a twist where he actually drops Lana into what has been previously established is dinosaur dung, and goes off with Tala instead. So it's so long ago I started on that plot synopsis, I forget why. But
well, the reason you were saying that is because of the character growth of Vatuk.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Which I do agree with. I think, you know, and I think I feel like me and you probably differ slightly on our opinion of this film, but the one thing I do agree with is I was actually surprised by there being significant character growth in this character for a film of this kind.
Yeah.
You don't expect that.
Yeah. But I think like that what I'm trying to get across is that I get what you're saying, that the sort of physical acting of it is not necessarily a massive challenge. But everyone in it has to be on their game and has to understand what their the kind of person their character is and what their character does, how their character would act in given situations, because all you can do is convey it through action and gesture. So everyone in it, I mean, Shelley Long is brilliant in it, to be honest.
Like, yeah, I agree with that too.
And you can completely see how it's easy to say these things with hindsight because we know she's Shelley Long, but
yeah.
I can imagine that if you saw that in 1981 and you'd never seen Shelley Long before, you would think like, oh, she's quite special. Like,
yeah. And also there's something quite approachable about her as a character. And I think you're right. I think we look at her and think of Diane, but I think audiences at that time would have looked at her and thought, she seems like someone you want to spend time with, so automatically she's someone you root for in that situation. Whereas Barbara Bach is beautiful, but there isn't actually anything else other to her character other than that.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas Shelley Long's character, and there is that scene where Shelley Long helps, and I should say Tala helps Atuk defeat Tonda, and then she feels like they're going to kiss or get together. But Atuk goes off with Lana, Barbara Bach.
Yeah.
And then there is quite a pause on Shelley Long's face as she sort of expresses being upset about that.
Yeah.
And it's done in a sort of comical girl next door kind of way.
Yeah.
But it is very expressive. And you get more from her in that moment than most actresses would give, I think, in that scene.
Yeah, actually. Because actually, like, you think about what she does as Diane in Cheers, and there's a lot of physicality in that performance as well, because like everyone around her in Cheers is very, very loose and relaxed.
Yeah,
you know, everyone else is completely comfortable with their surroundings because they spend every night in this bar.
Yeah,
and she is out of place there, and she is a bit stiff and a bit proper, and she kind of, you know, initially at least thinks she's better than the place, and she conveys that physically as much as she does through dialogue.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that the actors are doing an impressive job by conveying their character all the time without the need of dialogue.
Yeah,
I do agree with you on with Shelley Long, because I think she is giving more than is required of her in those scenes.
Yeah.
I do think that I think you're being generous to the other actors in the film. And I said that because I think the tropes that you mentioned there about, you know, like every man kid trying to, you know, dealing with a bully, being in love with the popular girl at school, mm-hmm. those kind of things. I think the film relies on those tropes to get those characters across, yeah. as much as the actors themselves. So I feel like the film leans into that formula a lot, and yeah. that's more the reason why it works, rather than the actors going above and beyond their acting prowess to sell it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of both, maybe, but I mean, I think...
it's just the one that I said.
Ah, right, okay. Sorry, I see that now. I think telling a very simple story is the point of something like this. It would be to do the whole thing without dialogue and tell like quite a nuanced story would sort of, I mean, A, be incredibly difficult and probably not very satisfying either. Mm. Because the point is that the audience is going to be, part of the audience satisfaction is that I understand what's going on here. So apparently in cinemas, when it was released in certain cinemas, like on the seats, people were given a pamphlet.
Yes, sort of explaining translating the language. The caveman yeah.
dialogue, which is sort of like cute and like a good bit of marketing. But sort of the point of it is that you don't need to understand it.
Yeah.
You are. So, I mean, when I said about Lana being dropped into what has been established is dinosaur dung earlier on, what I meant by that was that there is a scene earlier on where a group of them figure it out, and they use the word caca in the end to describe it.
Yeah,
that scene, by the way, I didn't find funny. Like, it's a bit scatological for my taste. I didn't think it was all that great. But what it is doing is establishing for you that this isn't just mud that he throws her into later on. You now know it, and it's that idea has been communicated to you.
Yeah, and I guess my point is, how did they communicate that?
Through the, I think they sort of, they walk into the place where the dung is, and they're kind of sniffing the air and things like that. And maybe that's about, I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, like that is communicated to you, but I don't think the film is, I felt like the film wasn't doing anything particularly trying in order to convey that. You know, I know what you're saying, like they've successfully established context for this ending without having someone explain there's some dinosaur dung.
Yeah,
but I feel like that's actually quite a simple thing to do in the visual medium of cinema. Basically have people, I generally can't remember what that was, but people walking into a room and sniffing a bit.
Yeah,
that does the job, right? Yeah. That's not, you know, maybe it's a...
Well, I mean, when you say it like that, it's much more nuanced than that.
And also, I guess there's definitely a question there around, you know, it's a simple story, and for a film like this that isn't using dialogue, then obviously a simple story is what you want from this, right? Because trying to tell a complex story that way is going to be unsatisfying.
Yeah.
The question I would sort of come back to you at is, then maybe don't tell a, maybe don't do that, and maybe tell a more interesting story, a less simple story, and have some compromise in the language. It's interesting, I found, that halfway through the film, Atuk meets another caveman who can speak English and is trying to teach him the English words for some of these things.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Much in the same way, I actually liked the gag where they just sort of crack each other's backs and they can suddenly stand up straight.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite fun. I actually wondered if this is going to be a step in their evolution. They were actually going to start using some proper English words now, but actually that was a gag.
Yeah, it was a single gag.
Yeah, that they didn't do.
Yeah, it's consistent with jokes that are being cracked throughout the whole thing, is that there are hints that this society is just on the cusp of...
Yeah.
And so they do discover things like fire for the first time.
Music,
There's a scene just at the start where Ringo is kind of sitting around idly, and he's got like a stick, which he's got a sort of, it's not quite a wheel, but he's kind of spinning it around and looking at it, and then just kind of throws it away. So the idea is like, oh, he's on the cusp of inventing the wheel, and maybe he'll do that in the next few days, but he's not done it yet. So that language thing is consistent with those jokes. That's what we're doing.
Yes.
I liked those jokes in general. I liked the idea that all this stuff is just about to happen, but it's not quite happening yet.
Yeah, I get that. I think one of the effects of that for me was I generally found that spending the entire film with them speaking the caveman language they do, I found that a little bit irritating.
Yeah.
And I'll lay my cards on the table here. I watched this film for free on YouTube, and it was one of those channels where it interrupts the film quite a lot with adverts.
Yeah, me too.
Which is it's a bad way of watching the film, I understand that, but also, you know, if there are any kids listening to this, it's how we used to watch films back in the day, so I felt like it was okay.
Yeah.
My film watching experience of this film was watching it on YouTube that was cut with YouTube ad breaks. It is the only time I can ever remember that when an advert break interrupted the film, it was welcome. I found the constant caveman grunts for the entirety of the film, I found that quite irritating over time.
Yeah. So I think, I found it a little irritating at times too, but I think that you kind of have to be absolutist about this sort of thing. It would be so much worse if, like, they sort of spoke half in caveman grunts, but also at other times spoken English.
Yeah.
In order to convey some more complex ideas. I think, like, we'd feel a bit cheated by that.
I think that's fair, actually. I see what you're saying.
Part of the appeal, if you want to say appeal, you probably don't, I think, but, like, but part of the appeal, if you like, is that it's a silent comedy, effectively. That's kind of what's being done.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I think that the concept of the film, I think, is perhaps a little bit flawed. And I think that it's interesting. I was reading Roger Ebert wrote a review of the film when it came out. And he said that in his review of the film, that the biggest flaw, or he deemed that the biggest flaw of the film was it's a parody or satirizing something, but it's not actually satirizing any particular kind of material.
Yeah.
The idea itself is what is funny. And looking at a lot of the people who worked on the film, both in front of and behind the camera, there's a lot of people who have ties to Mel Brooks and what he was doing at that time, which makes sense to me because there's a lot of similarities in the tone of the film. But I kind of agree that it feels to me like it's almost like what you'd have as a repeat sketch in a sketch show, as opposed to drawing out a 90-minute film from, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like I can understand how somebody would approach a movie and feel like this would be good and a good story to tell, but actually on the whole it feels a bit drawn out, and I think that nobody really thought of the fact that watching this kind of thing for 90 minutes might actually end up being quite irritating or annoying or frustrating for a lot of audience members.
Yeah, fair enough. And listen, I mean, like, most audience members were on your side with this, you know. I think they very much voted with their feet.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, fair enough.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
¶¶
We should probably touch on, and already regressing that turn of phrase, how the film presents, and I want to use the phrase gender politics, but what I really mean is boobs.
Yes.
There's a lot of boobs in the film. The film is a bit boob obsessed. It makes me realise, actually, that when we talk about like Carry On movies, we think of that as being a very sort of UK specific type of comedy, but yeah. Around the same time the US was, I think, going through a similar kind of comedy genre where this sort of the same sort of sense of bawdiness was coming through a lot there. I think, you know, we've seen it in some of the other films that we discussed, but in this film in particular there is a mad obsession with boobies.
Yes, there seemed to be. Yeah, so I mean, so obviously, you know, as I say, the actors have to express a lot through gestures. So you can imagine the sort of gestures that Ringo is making.
Yes.
In this context, throughout the film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's those gestures. There is the scene where I think his name is Grog, the blind man.
Yep.
Is confused because he is feeling a boob, one boob each of two women.
Yep.
But is confused because he thinks it's one woman.
Yep.
And it's quite a long scene of him yeah. establishing.
It's longer than it needs to be.
Yeah, it certainly is. Yeah. And then until he then establishes, actually, no, it's two women, and continues touching their boobs. Like, yeah. This is, you know, this is to say one of many, I think, scenes where, yeah, boobs are the focus.
Yeah, and so this is not the first time that a Ringo Starr film has been one that we've called its gender politics into question.
No, incidentally, the one of the last times we did talk about this was Four Magic Christian, and the scene in question for that film was when he was with Raquel Welsh, who was the slave driver of...
Oh, the galley slaves on
yeah,
the ship.
All yeah, of the yeah. naked women rowing the ship, which... in hindsight, wasn't actually going anywhere anyway.
Yes.
And obviously, you know, Raquel Welsh being the star of 1 Million Years BC that this film is based on.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so I suppose, like, you know, the sex comedy is kind of a big thing at this time.
Mm.
And so certainly that is, you know, speaking of Dudley Moore, like,
yes,
that's what he's doing a lot of.
Yes.
Around this time, I suppose.
Dustin Hoffman there regretting his life choices.
Yeah, yeah. But I suppose also, you know, when you think of those sort of like beta male... leading men, Woody Allen is one as well.
Mm.
You know, sort of putting himself in his films, playing those roles where, you know, he is sort of getting the girl, but in a way that is sort of ridden with his own neuroses and anxiety, is sort of to the fore.
Yeah,
and that's it's similar to what's going on here. So you get from Ringo's performance that he is, you know, he's not the tough guy, but he sort of wins the girl in the end, or wins the battle in the end through ingenuity rather than brute force. Although actually, in his final battle with Tonda, there was a bit too much brute force on Ringo's part. Right, to be honest, where I kind of thought, like, oh, you've just hit him with a bone or something like that.
Yes, no. Yeah.
But there are bits where he sort of discovered, he's invented the slingshot and invented the axe, basically, in order to do these things. So it is ingenuity. But then it's one of those slightly unsatisfying fight scenes where actually it does rely on Ringo, who is nowhere near as hard as this guy, just hitting him.
Just hitting harder. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're completely
right.
A bit too much. I think you're right about that. I think there is definitely a turning point at this age of cinema where there is a focus more on sort of the underdog becoming sort of, you know, getting their victory.
Yeah.
But going back to boobs.
Yes.
Because that is an important point. It's a good point to make. But specifically about boobs.
Yes.
I know we always say this, that phrase that I feel like is haunting us in this podcast now, which is, it was, you know, of its time.
Yes, 1 zillion BC.
Yeah. 1 zillion BC specifically, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I do wonder about the scene in particular where Ringo is getting intimate with... Barbara Bach while she's sleeping.
Yes, attempting to.
And being foiled in the process, right?
Yeah,
so it's obviously played for comedy value.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a little bit... You wouldn't fly now.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And quite rightly. So, yeah, so, of course, what's happening here is he's drugged her and he's drugged Tonda so that they're asleep.
Yeah.
And the idea is he's sort of trying to... Well, it's kidnapping her, basically, isn't it?
Mm.
But he is also trying to have sex with her while she's asleep, which yes. includes him sort of like jumping on top of what he believes is her and then sort of like doing pelvic thrusts before realizing it's actually a rock.
Yes.
Rather than her. So like, yeah, this is, it's an attempted rape essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know where we go with that conversation, well, honestly.
Well, no, because not it's, really. But also it reminds me that, that if you think about that'll be the day, that'll be the day has like quite a nasty rape in it.
Yeah.
By David Essex, not by David Essex. I'm sure David Essex has never raped anyone, but by the character that David Essex plays, and Ringo as his friend, is the sort of voice of reason, and Ringo yes. calls him out on it.
Or yeah.
Mike, the character who Ringo plays,
that's right,
calls him out on it. So I think in that film, certainly, you know, we discussed the fact that he's a bit of a womanizer in that film, and he's very, very flawed as a character, but also he fundamentally knows right from wrong.
Yeah.
And I think you can always root for Ringo, or you always feel like you're going to be on his side because you fundamentally got that.
Yes. And I think that's a really good point, because I think that's because it's Ringo, you mean?
Yeah.
So it's not just the way the character's written, but yeah. Ringo is well cast in that role because he's automatically going to have audience sympathies on his side.
Yeah, absolutely. Because your perception of him,
yeah.
because the person you know him to be, and you know the fact that you like the Beatles and you like Ringo, elides with the character.
Yeah.
So I suppose, you know, it happened again in Blind Man, where the first thing you see him do is hit and rape a woman. So there, obviously, you know, we talked a bit about, you know, Blind Man, the idea that he was obviously trying to stretch himself as an actor a bit.
Yes.
And him getting this part in Caveman, which, by the way, is the lead role. This is the first Ringo film we've talked about where he's playing the lead.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's quite unusual for him, it seems, at this point. So I think he's sort of enjoying the challenge of this role, the physical challenge of this role. But I think probably it's sexual politics he's not thinking about too much.
No.
And also, by the way, there is a cartoonish quality to it. As we said, yeah. it's got stop motion dinosaurs. So, and obviously the way in which he is acting, what is essentially an attempted kidnap and rape, is cartoonish and
yeah.
slapsticky. You know.
Yeah, and I do agree. I mean, it does now put new context on all the people in the US that watched this as kids, because yeah. it was a little bit unsavory now. But yeah, also brings to mind, you just mentioned now three films in that we've covered in the Ringo Starr acting oeuvre that feature rape scenes. So that's an interesting.
It does seem to crop up a lot. It
does,
doesn't it?
Yeah. Interesting career choice. But let's not dwell on it too much. I mean, I know that you're right. It's played out in a comedy way. Ultimately, the film is, you could argue, the film is, by foiling his attempts in that scene, is sort of on the right side of those sort of sexual politics, because karmically, Ringo isn't getting Atuk isn't getting what he's trying to achieve in that moment.
Yeah, and this is the Atuk we meet at the start of
yes.
the film, who is kind of sex obsessed, and as we've discussed, lusting after the wrong woman,
yes,
doing so for the wrong reasons, you know. So one of the points of this trope is that the character ultimately learns the value of true relationships, and that it isn't just sort of empty and sexual, that
yes.
there's substance to them as well.
Yeah. We've mentioned Tonda quite a lot of times now.
Yeah,
Tonda being the big brutish, bullyish leader.
Yeah.
Do you know what else he has been in?
No, the guy...
As an actor?
Yeah, so I forget the guy's name, but he's an American football player.
He's an American footballer. His name is John Matuszak.
Okay.
I was so excited to learn this. He's Sloth in The Goonies.
Is he?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know, right?
Oh, okay.
Isn't
right.
that cool?
Right.
Yeah, oh, completely unrecognisable, obviously, because of, I'm assuming, lots of makeup.
Yeah.
But yeah. Hey, you guys. That's him. That's that guy.
Well,
I'm not taking that anywhere else other than just to land that with you, because I was quite excited to read that.
Okay.
But talking about other actors, should we talk? Dennis Quaid is in this film.
Dennis Quaid is
in this film.
Yeah.
As a very young, lean Dennis Quaid. He's like he's a proper young man.
Yeah, I didn't recognise him initially. Actually.
No, same.
Other than I was looking out for him because I saw his name on the credits, having not been aware that he was in it until I started watching it. Yeah, so this is not So unlike Shelley Long, like Dennis Quaid has already been doing movies for, it looks like, about 4 or 5 years by this point.
Yeah.
You know? So he is, so I'm not saying he is a big sort of, he's certainly not an established star or anything, but he is a kind of experienced actor.
That's weird, isn't it? Because you kind of feel like, I don't know about you, but watching this film, I imagined whilst watching it that this is a Ringo Starr vehicle and that all of the other actors around him are unknowns at this time.
Yeah.
And any sort of fame that we attach to them would have come after this movie.
Yeah.
You mentioned to me earlier before we started recording this that obviously Barbara Bach would have been in The Spy Who Loved Me before this film. She's like the main Bond girl.
1977, yeah.
So in that movie. Yeah. And then in this, it's actually a small role that she has here.
Yeah.
And Dennis Quaid, you know, the regardless of the sort of how famous he was at the time of this film, it's a relatively small role. It's like it's, I guess he's probably one of the main lead co-stars. He's definitely one of the main lead co-stars.
Yeah.
But it's not a very rewarding role.
No, not necessarily. I suppose he has a bit of a showpiece bits where he goes off and sort of accidentally wanders into an ice age.
Yeah.
Which was a joke I really liked, by the way. It's like the suggestion that there was an ice age just sort of next door.
Yes, it's approaching, yes.
Yeah. Which they can sort of come and go from by walking through a door.
I like that joke. I didn't like it when they discovered him later on and he was frozen. And him being frozen just appeared to be him standing motionless behind some cellophane that they were trying to pass off as like an ice block.
Pretty much, or something. Yeah.
It was a really poor, like even for this film, it's a pretty poor special effect.
Yeah, yeah. But he was, because he was frozen while being chased by the abominable snowman.
Yes.
And was frozen in a position of running and fear while looking back at him.
Yeah, yeah.
Which again is a good visual joke. Yeah.
The idea of it being like a flash freeze of him in motion is quite funny, exactly. Isn't it? Yeah.
So he did get the chance in that bit, I think, to sort of flex his chops a little bit, I suppose, you know. But of course not. There's not loads. But I mean, I don't get the impression that, I don't know, but I don't think Dennis Quaid was well known at this point. I think he had just done a few films.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's fair. Nice to see him crop up in this, actually. And I do think you get the sense that he is sort of one of the better presences in the film.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, whereas like with Barbara Bach, I get the impression that they are playing on the Bond girl thing a bit. When she is first introduced, what sounds like quite a James Bond-ish sort of love theme.
Oh, really? Seems I didn't to play, okay.
Which sounded quite sort of Roger Moore era. You know,
yeah, that sort of like kind of stirring whimsical strings kind of thing.
Yeah, 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 exactly. So, yeah, I got the impression that that is kind of what they were doing. And I also noticed, which, I mean, by the way, this can't be a reference to a James Bond film because the actual film didn't then happen for another 20 years or so. But, like, she accidentally crushes Ringo's head with her thighs.
Oh, yeah, like Goldeneye.
Like in Goldeneye.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's something on the top, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But, Bianca Jensen.
That is a very sort of Bond girlish trope of sort of the sort of sexy femme fatale, like being able to do a man some damage, but in a kind of sexual way.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, yeah. That kind of thing.
And who's to say that Martin Campbell, director of Goldeneye, didn't actually take that from Caveman?
Exactly. I think we can safely assume that he did.
He did, yeah, exactly. Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, yeah, prove us wrong.
Yeah.
Talking of the film's legacy, by the way, it's probably a good time to mention Zug Zug.
Yeah.
Do you know about Zug Zug?
Zug Zug.
Yes. Zuzug in the film means sex, to have
right?
sex.
Right, yeah.
There's a whole other meaning, I think, particularly online gamers. Zuzug is one of the main phrases that the orcs in World of Warcraft say.
Really?
Yeah, and you'll know this about me, not a gamer.
No.
So I can't really say about in what context. I think it's to do with something working right or to perform some kind of action, but they say Zug Zug a lot.
Okay.
So it's taken on a life of its own, this phrase.
Right.
But it is directly attributable from this film.
Oh, it's not just a coincidence.
No. It's actually it's in the phrase originated with Caveman and has been employed in that film. But so there are I read by chance, I read something about somebody mentions Zsuzsu coming from this film and looks it up. And it's, yeah, there's a whole reference, library of references to it online about in relation to World of Warcraft.
Wow. I had no
idea. So if there was one thing that the film sort of gave the rest of the world, it's the phrase Zsuzsu that orcs say in an online role-playing game, but originally meant in this film to have sex.
Well, it's worth it for that.
Yeah. And like you were saying earlier, if a film achieves what it set out to do... you mentioned the music earlier. I did want to talk about... I did find it quite interesting, some of the musical choices that were made.
Yeah.
The score does play actual sort of familiar classical compositions a few times throughout the movie. I'm trying to think of what's the one that's... So at one point in the film, it plays the William Tell Overture, I think.
Yep.
But the one that interested me most was when they discover fire...
Yeah.
The score plays a sort of like a sounder-like version of Strauss's, and I'm going to mess up the pronunciation of this, but I think it's Thus Spake Zarathustra, I think. I just messed it up.
That's just a noise.
Thus Spake Zarathustra. I don't know. But it's the famous music from 2001 A Space Odyssey, right? So when the apes are bashing bones on the ground and they discover the monolith. That famous sort of like dawn is coming music, familiar to everyone. But I just found it really interesting that the film played like a fake version of that. Like it's directly referencing that music, but not actually playing the exact music, which I thought was odd because there's no copyright issue involved in performing that.
Well, so. No, I guess not. But because they are using. I liked the way that they used. They discover a massive dinosaur egg at one point, and they're walking off with it, and you get Colonel Bogey playing under it. You know, old thing. You know, sort of. Makes you think of like old military films.
That's right,
where they're marching. You know, it's a marching song essentially. Yeah. So there's no reason why. They wouldn't have just used the same thing. So that is a bit distracting, I suppose, especially when obviously what you're trying to do is parody something.
Yes. Yeah, so, you expect that to be played more directly.
I guess so, yeah, because obviously, you know, like I'm defending this film more than you are, but like I'm not going to say that, you know, it's the choices it makes are particularly nuanced ones most of the time. So if you're going to make a joke like that, I would expect it to be more on the nose.
Exactly, you
know? But in general, there were bits of the score where, you know, I was listening, I was watching, and the score would come up, and I thought, oh, this is better than I would expect it to be. Like, you know, this score seems to be quite deft in places, you know, and like sort of quite stirring. So the score was by a guy called Lalo Schifrin,
right,
who also wrote, it turns out, the Mission Impossible theme.
Oh, did it? Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course. No, I recognize his name now.
Yeah.
You butchered the pronunciation.
Yeah. God forbid.
But no, of course. Yeah, that's right. Wow. Yeah. Wow, and he wrote the score for this. That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so, the score was, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't tend to pick up on the scores of films all that much.
Yeah, same.
You know, it's not something, you know, we're recording this a couple of weeks after the release of Oppenheimer, and like when I went to see Oppenheimer at the cinema, I was quite struck by the fact that the score is going on in pretty much every scene.
Mm.
You don't really get a break from it. And I think after the bomb goes off, then it stops.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that having watched Oppenheimer, I didn't think about the score once.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the kind of claim that would infuriate score enthusiasts.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure if you're really into musical score, it's the kind of film that plays a big part in that cinematic experience for them. But yeah, it's not something that I ever really pick up on when I'm watching a film.
No, I don't tend to. But I did with this. And like I say, I just thought it was well used. And, you know, I found bits of it stirring and just sort of like quite cleverly placed.
Mm. No, fair. I mean, I will say, but this the same day I watched Oppenheimer, I did watch Barbie. Movie, and I did notice Dua Lipa's "Dance the Night Away," which is a great song. So almost if that song had been used in Oppenheimer,
yeah,
then I would have noticed it then. And who's to say that would have been better?
Well, yeah. I mean, the film is the poorer for not using that. I think we can all agree on that. Yeah.
We talked very early on at the start of this about Ringo's performance. Completely forgot to mention one of the most incredible things I think about his portrayal in this film is that somehow throughout the entire movie, Ringo's caveman grunts and nonsensical words still come through with a very strong Liverpudlian accent. Yeah. It really stands out.
Yeah, exactly.
When he first did it, I was like, oh wow, that is that is an unusual accent to have in 1 zillion BC.
yeah. But I mean, you wouldn't want it any other way, would you?
No, exactly.
You
know,
if you're going to cast Ringo Starr, then that's kind of what you want from him.
That's exactly right. And what better sentiment to end on than that?
Dustin Hoffman couldn't have done it.
No, Dudley Moore could have. But anyway, we would love to hear from you. If anyone's listening to this right now, please tell us what you think. Did you alunder the film? Or did you think it was caca? Please get in touch with us. We're on all the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode or any of our other episodes, please feel free to leave us a 5-star rating or a review on your podcast listening platform of choice. Otherwise, we'll see you again next week for another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.